At the outset, nothing in this podcast should be interpreted as legal advice. Further, the views or opinions expressed in this podcast do not represent those of the university. Please email campbelllawreporter@email.campbell.edu for any media inquiries and third-party distributions. Welcome to the Campbell Law Reporter Podcast. This legal podcast strives to expand Campbell University's mission to lead with purpose by reporting with purpose. We hope to breathe new life into the dusty reporters on the shelves by reporting the content through captivating discussions. Our mission is to provide current and interesting reporting on legal topics affecting today's professionals. Listeners can expect to hear from various hosts throughout the year.
Thank you for joining us for the Campbell Law Reporter Podcast. My name is Brian Hedrick. Now, here at Campbell, we have a saying, lead with purpose. Now, that's one of those things that's easy to say, but hard to do. So when I find someone who's so clearly leading with purpose, I want to sit down and interview that person. So about 3 or 4 years ago, when I was in my final year at UNCG, I read this book, which I'm holding up, but it's a podcast, so maybe I am holding it up, maybe I'm not. But I read that book, and it's called Stand Up That Mountain. When I read it, I could tell the person had real passion behind it and that they were leading with a purpose. So I flipped it over, and this guy who wrote it was named Jay Lutze. So I wanted at some point to talk with that person, so I sent an email last week, and surprisingly, he responded very quickly and agreed to talk. So I'm excited today to be joined by one of the nation's leaders in land conservation law, a senior advisor to the Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy, recipient of the Order of the Longleaf Pine, and author of that very book, Stand Up That Mountain, Jay Lutze. Thank you for joining us.
I'm really glad to be here.
So as I mentioned in that really long intro, you are somebody who leads with purpose. And I think the best way to understand someone is to understand what motivates them. So what motivates you? What's your why?
Fear is a powerful motivator. It's a good question. I think that for a lot of people in the field of conservation, we are drawn to the field because it addresses a sense of loss. And it's funny, I think of myself as a very optimistic person. I like solving problems, and that's why you go to law school, right? To learn how to solve problems. But I watched the North Carolina that I grew up in change radically. And I'm talking about the natural world, the land itself, the forests, the places that I love the most, changed a lot during my childhood as the state grew in population, as roads expanded, as developers targeted the state and tourist development groups started touting the benefits of North Carolina, and the places that I grew up loving started to seem really fragile to me.
Right. So you mentioned growing up here, and I think you're originally from Virginia, but then grew up most of your time here. So whether you want to talk about Virginia or North Carolina, what are some of your first memories of nature or of land?
So my earliest memories of nature are being in mountain creeks, being in clean water, cold water. You know, I went to summer camp. My parents shipped me off to summer camp in Brevard and passed the cold water, deep water swimming test, swimming around with newts and salamanders. And just really, that's a real connection to nature when it envelops you in that way when you're in the water. And as I grew a little bit older and I realized that not all of our streams are swimmable and fishable, and there's a reason for that, and that people are responsible for keeping our streams clean, but also people can be part of the problem and can foul our streams so that you shouldn't swim in them. And that struck me as an absolute crisis that needed to be addressed.
Right. So is that why you went to law school, or was there something else you wanted to go to law school for? Because you took a really interesting path in going there and then kind of immediately getting out.
Yeah. So I was one of those kids. I bet a lot of people in law school relate to this. I got told as a child a lot, that kid is going to grow up to be a lawyer. And what that meant was that kid talks a lot. And I liked arguing. I liked testing my hypotheses at the dinner table, and I got told a lot that I ought to be a lawyer. So I didn't know a lot of lawyers growing up. I grew up in Chapel Hill. I know a lot of teachers, but I thought, Well, teaching and the law are really pretty similar. The common thread was I was always a bookworm. I loved reading, and it seemed like law was a career, or at least a discipline, when you're studying it, where you read a lot, and it's all stories. So I was really drawn to that, and I thought, boy, if I can stay in school for three more years and sharpen my skills for storytelling and communicating, which is what I really like to do, while reading, seems like a win.
And I saw in a, I think it was PBS, or maybe it was a UNC TV one, that you had a drawer full of novels that you are writing. Are you still writing like that? And that's still kind of a dream for you to do that.
I do. I'm sitting about 2 feet away right now from a briefcase with a book that I've written that I haven't showed to anybody. And it's strange that you ask this question right now, because I just gifted that desk to my nephew. And boy, it took a long time to load all the paper out of it. I've got thousands and thousands of pages of unpublished poetry, short stories, two novels, and nonfiction book, most of which I will never show to anybody. But that's part of the old universe that was before a paperless world. We printed out a lot of things, and we wrote out in longhand, and I've got a lot of stacks of paper with ideas and chapters, and maybe I'll get to all of it one day.
You also, again, like I mentioned, took a really interesting path. You go to law school, and I saw in that interview that you actually had like a big law job in Boston, and you did what I think anyone would do, right? You packed your bags and you went to the mountains of North Carolina. Very different.
Wasn't that a great idea?
I mean, were the people in law school just that bad that you wanted to go hide away in the mountains?
It's interesting. I probably knew in my first week of law school that I was not going to practice law. As I spent more time with my classmates and I saw how motivated they were by particular parts of the law, I realized that I wanted to study law. I didn't want to practice it.
Right.
And so I, right after law school, I got on an airplane and I traveled around the world. You used to be able to get an airline ticket for $2,600 that would enable you to fly all the way around the world as long as you kept going in the same direction. So I told you my first love was books, and I got a job in a bookstore in London, England. And I had lived in England for a year as a child and always wanted to go back there. And they were kind of surprised that a person fresh out of law school would want to sell books. But I wanted to learn that trade. I wanted to live in London. I wanted more adventures. And I fully intended to one day go back home and pass the bar. And then life intervened, and I never did. So I've never been admitted to the bar, but I pretty quickly started using my law degree in a legal case where I was more the plaintiff. I certainly wasn't the attorney. I was bringing the cause of action. And now, in working in the land trust world, I buy land for public purposes, for state parks, national forests, trails. I use the law all the time in negotiating with landowners to purchase land that will become public land.
Talking about that case, the area that you're around, that mountain area, can you kind of describe that area? I know you do it a little bit in your book, and I imagine the area itself is one of those things of like, you just kind of have to see it to be able to know what it is. But I think you describe it very well in that book. Could you try to replicate that here?
Sure, especially on a day like today, the day that we're talking, there are heat waves hitting around the world. And most of North Carolina is very hot, but it is not hot in Avery County today. It is nice and cool. So I live in a very cool, lush forest. It's old growth forest broken by meadows and pastures and high elevation, what are called grassy balls. Areas at the tops of some of our mountains don't have trees, and they offer views for hundreds of miles on clear days. You're really up in the clouds. The second closest to the elementary school in the town of Roan Mountain is named Cloudland, and that's because we're often in the clouds, so it's a high elevation mountain landscape. When I talk about places changing a lot, it has not changed as much as other places. There hasn't been a lot of development in this area. So there's still some old traditions that have deep roots and will persist into the future. So it's a special place.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand that and to kind of get a picture of it, and probably for everyone just to go see it at some point, so that you can actually understand what you're really talking about and what you're fighting for in doing it. So land conservation's a pretty large topic. Could you try to, in about, you know, a minute or two, kind of condense what that is, what everyone needs to know about it?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different ways that we accomplish land conservation. And start with the premise that we are in a global crisis, a climate crisis and a biodiversity and habitat crisis. We are changing the world, our species, people. We are changing the planet very, very quickly by fragmenting forests, by moving subdivisions out into areas that were countryside, by burning fossil fuels, and animals and plant life, which feed us and feed a healthy ecosystem, which we need to rely upon to provide the sources of life, the wellsprings of life, are under enormous stress. So how do we address that crisis? We can regulate our way, which is a very expensive process, and industry doesn't like to be regulated, so it leads to lots of fights, and I've been involved in those fights. Or we can buy more land and protect it in its natural state. That's what the second half of my career has been dedicated to. It's a less expensive way, and it uses market forces. Land comes on the market for sale. If it has strategic conservation value as a wildlife passage or as a carbon sequestering forest, we try to buy it. We raise money, we buy it. It becomes public land, it belongs to all of us, and then we hope that we'll manage and steward it so that it can provide ecosystem services.
Yeah, and one of the things I like, we had our little pre-meeting before this meeting, we were talking about, you know, why we're doing this type of episode right now, and you said, you know, one of the things you tell lobbyists is about, you know, going in and saying this is going to be the funnest meeting a member of Congress is going to have, you know, talking about all this stuff, and yeah, I can tell you really have fun doing it. Kind of, you know, if you want to repeat what you said to me earlier and kind of re-pitch that, why is this an area of law that's fun to practice?
Yeah, when you think about, if you look at all the areas of law in which you might practice, an area of law that gets you outside into the forest, into the woods. Part of my job is taking people fishing so that I can demonstrate the value of clean water. That's a nice day at the office. I take people on hikes. I've taken members of Congress on hikes. I've taken the Secretary of the Interior on a hike on the Appalachian Trail to demonstrate what's important about North Carolina's landscapes in particular. And so that's my work. It's pretty good. I also get to buy land using other people's money, as we say. So I don't have any money to buy land. I'm working on a deal right now that is $9 million. I don't have $9 million, but I can work with lots and lots of public and private partners to put together a deal that will eventually raise $9 million and will create a new park in Buncombe County, 343 acres on the top of a mountain that overlooks the city of Asheville, and everybody will have access to it. That is fun. It feels good. It helps the planet. And it's really inspiring. So it's easy to wake up in the morning and want to go to work when that's your task.
Definitely. So, again, we mentioned this book earlier, Stand Up That Mountain. You wrote that book about 10 years ago, I think, right? And the events in the book happened like 20 years ago, right?
Yes.
Okay, so again, I read this book a while ago, so it's been a while for me. I tried to go back and skim some parts of it again. There's probably some people listening to this who haven't read the book. If you could, without giving spoilers, just kind of give a little brief of what this case was about, because the book's about a court case that you were involved in. Kind of explain what it's about.
Sure. So one of the things you can already tell about me after just a few minutes is I love being outside. I love nature. And about 20 years ago, I started hearing, when I was on the Appalachian Trail, trees falling across the valley, noisy chainsaws, trees hitting the forest floor. I started to ask around what in the world was going on over on Bellevue Mountain. And it turned out that the largest surface mine in Western North Carolina was planned for a ridge right next to the Appalachian Trail, which is a treasured place for hikers. we love it because it's scenic and because it's silent. And having a mine right next to the trail meant it wasn't going to be scenic anymore, and it certainly wasn't going to be silent, at least for the 100 years of the lease. I started looking into the lease process and the permitting process, and it turned out that this permit, mining permit, had been issued without any public hearings. And I knew that that was not okay, but I couldn't figure out what the cause of action might be and who might be the plaintiff, who had standing to sue to protect nature and to protect against a noisy intrusion on a national park unit, which the Appalachian Trail is. It's a very skinny national park unit. So I talked to the best lawyers I could find, and that led me to Southern Environmental Law Center, which has an office in Chapel Hill. And they determined that this permit never should have been issued because North Carolina has a statute and there's federal law supporting due process, where if you're going to issue a mining permit, if the state is, they have to have public hearings to find out if there's a church next door or a cemetery or a school or a nursing home or a publicly owned park, forest, or recreation area. So that was the crux of the case. We were suing to compel the state to revoke a permit that they never should have issued.
Yeah, so I think that was one of the things that really grabbed me about this book and seemed most interesting, is it wasn't like this, you know, really obviously egregious, horrible thing that this company came in and did. It was a really small, seemingly small procedural thing that had these ramifications that were in themselves really huge. I mean, it's surprising. You know, I think there are a lot of people who would say, well, that's a small rule. Like, okay, there wasn't a proper public hearing on it. Okay, so what? Like, this is going to be good, you know, for the economy. It's good for jobs. We need gravel. We need all this stuff. So, like, what's the big deal? So I really like that, you know, you were able to focus on something that many people may not see as a big deal. And really, there were two things. There was the legal side of it and the advocacy side of it. And I think you kind of had one of the first really kind of grassroots movements into this of getting that support. And I know you, like, had town halls you were hosting and things like that. So can you kind of talk about first some of the advocacy of it, of how you garnered support and how maybe you dealt with people who could have benefited from that? I think it was a relatively small area, and it wasn't like there weren't many like rich people in the area, people who really needed these jobs. So how did you kind of grapple with dealing with those personalities?
Yeah, I think the law becomes very powerful when it's animated by people. So it's during the 3 years that you're in law school and you're buried in case law, it's really easy to read these cases and forget that these are actual people that devote years of their lives to seeing these cases through to a final resolution. So in this case, the people that were most impacted were not the Appalachian Trail hikers, but the local families that lived right next to the mine site where the first shots of dynamite interrupted their water flow from their natural springs. And I got a call from a woman who said that her rights were being violated by the existence of this mining operation in her neighborhood. And the question immediately became, well, wait a minute, why didn't you complain in advance? Why'd you wait until they'd already spent a lot of money building a road and sinking equipment into the hillside and drilling and putting dynamite in the holes and blowing it up before you complained? Well, that's what public hearings are. And public hearings have to happen before all that investment, or else you've squandered the opportunity to hear from people what is at stake. So what we learned was that Ollie Cox and Ashley Cook and Freddie Carpenter, Dallas Cox, they lived right next to this site, and their shelves were shaking in their house when the mining company pulled shots of dynamite. The state was basically flying blind because the mining company submitted a mining permit that didn't have full information on it. And then the state, being underfunded, as they chronically are, the mining division didn't really have the staff to run down and knock on everybody's door and say, hey, you didn't submit any public comments. Would you really like to say anything now? Instead, nobody raised public comments in what looked like a normal procedure, and only later, when we uncovered that the mining map had closed everyone out of their opportunity to complain beforehand, did we have a case.
Okay, yeah, because that's one of the things I think, you know, that I've been most interested in, is making sure that everyone has a seat at the table, everyone has their voice heard, and that the proper procedures followed. So to me, when I read this book, that's really what it was more about. It wasn't so much about, you know, environmental law or land conservation. It was about ensuring that everyone, especially kind of the small people who are marginalized in some ways, are having their voice heard. And I like the way that you start this book. You said, and here's a quote. It's going to sound like I didn't read it because it's the very first line of the book, but I did. Here's the first line of the book. It says, for me, this is how it started, with a call. I like that line for two reasons. One is that it seems like such a small, simple thing. It's just someone called you. Do you ever think about what would have happened, you know, if you didn't answer that call? Or if this person got your information, just didn't ever get around to calling you? Or if you got the call and was like, why is this for me? Like, this has to be like a joke or something.
100%. And the reason I got the call was because the neighbors to the mine site were at the local grocery store, ran into a neighbor of mine. They were complaining to each other about the noise, and one of them mentioned that I went to law school. And so I'm sure with an ink pen, he wrote down the number, or there was a phone book 20 years ago where you could look up, as long as you knew somebody's name, you looked up their name in the phone book and you dialed, and a physical phone on the wall rang and you picked it up, or you didn't. Now we all have cell phones and it's easy to receive emails. People can find you on social media perhaps, but I do think all the time about when my phone rings and it's a number I don't recognize, I don't pick it up. Nor do I have voicemail activated on my phone because I can't keep up with all the calls.
Yeah.
And so I have an automatic response that says, please text me if you need me. Now, if somebody doesn't have text capability on their phone, that's call I'm going to miss. And so, yeah, I do think about that. We've had a revolution in technology that makes it easier to reach out to people in some ways. But a lot of people, as you say, who are marginalized, who don't have smartphones, are getting left behind in their ability to reach out and find help.
Right. And the second thing that line makes me think of, for me, this started with a call. It makes me think of, could you say for me? It makes me think that, you know, as lawyers, we come in where maybe we're seeing somebody at their worst, but we're not seeing them as the worst is happening to them, right? So you say for me, and that this is when you came into it, but it makes me think there's so much more that happened, like maybe another book's worth of what happened before you ever get really involved into this story.
That's absolutely right. I'd say in Appalachia, which is the region we're talking about, there's a long history of exploitation of land and of people. And there is a residue of distrust of outsiders because of timber companies exploiting this landscape, mining companies exploiting the landscape, people buying rights to land for pennies on the dollar from buyers or from sellers and landowners who may not have been spending a lot of time down at the courthouse and haven't been pulling up comparable land sales to know what their land is worth. And so we're definitely in a era where people are becoming more empowered using some of the tools. In this case, a 14-year-old girl that lived next to the mine site was given a dial-up internet connection by her uncle, and she read the Mining Act of 1971 and was convinced that there was a cause of action here, and that inspired her to call me.
Yeah, that's really a cool part, and why I think people should read this book still, even though it's been a while since this happened, is, I mean, yeah, somebody who was, you know, 14, researched the law, and was able to get the resources together to really make something happen from this. Again, it goes to that, you know, leading with purpose, and what's kind of your why, starting with the why of it all, is seeing people who are really motivated to do something can make a real difference. And that leads into the next question is, what do you think would have happened had, you know, nobody was motivated enough? If, you know, she didn't call you or you didn't take the case, what do you think would have happened if you had just lost this case? How would that impact other areas of the country?
So this is what's exciting about the law. When you win a case that is grounded in good law, you set a precedent that hopefully in that organic mishmash of the living thing we call the law becomes better with each generation. It becomes smarter. It becomes more nimble. It narrows in. It is alive. And so winning a case is tremendously important. So now the state of North Carolina does not issue mining permits the same way that it issued mining permits before this case. The state of North Carolina does not want to get sued again by a group of disgruntled local residents who take them through the court system for 4 years with great arguments, brilliantly argued, not by me, but by Trip Van Oppen and Dan Gulick, lawyers representing Southern Environmental Law Center and the state of North Carolina. But that's a costly endeavor for the state and for everyone involved. So the law is now better because of this case, and there's an alarm bell that goes off when the mining division receives a map from someone requesting a mining permit. They now know to not fall for the trick of a concocted buffer around the mine that claims that, hey, we don't join anybody. We don't have to notify anybody because we pulled our buffer 50 feet in around every contour on our map. So it looks like we don't join anybody, so we don't have to notify anybody of their right to a public hearing. That does not happen anymore.
So again, this was a while ago, and a lot has changed since then. Do you still keep up with some of the main people that you met and talked to in this book?
All of them. All of them all the time.
Right. Kind of where?
This is what I tell students when I get a chance to talk to students. You're meeting people right now in law school that will be part of your life for the rest of your career and hopefully your social life, and some of you will meet your spouses while you're in law school. This case for me was like graduate school, another level of graduate school, and I formed bonds with the people that I walked through these fires with, and we all keep in touch with each other. They helped me in my career. I like to think every once in a while I help them, as we all have, as we wade through this journey of life. We're still very connected.
Yeah, if you want to share, if they want to, you know, stay private, that's fine too. But where are some of them now, some of the main characters of this book?
So Trip Van Oppen, who was the attorney who represented us from the Southern Environmental Law Center, left the Southern Environmental Law Center and went to Earth Justice, which used to be the legal arm of the Sierra Club. And he moved to Oakland, California, but he is a North Carolina guy, and so still maintains strong ties to the Morganton area. Pam Underhill, I just got an email from the other day. Pam was the superintendent for the Appalachian Trail when the case was going on. She gave testimony in a public hearing that was spot on and brilliant. And I took her hiking the next morning and she fell in love with the landscape. She has retired now and lives in Harpers Ferry, which is the headquarters of the Appalachian Trail. Dan Gulick is still very active in North Carolina. Dan Hirschman is working with the state. Ashley Cook is right where she was in Cranberry Gap, and there's not a mine rattling the windows of her house. And I talk to Ashley all the time.
And where are you now? So I know you're an advisor to the Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy. I know you also helped pass the Great American Outdoors Act. Kind of what are those things and what are you doing with them?
Yeah, so career-wise, I am a consultant. So I work for Southern Appalachian, I have two clients. One is Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy, and I've been president of the board of this organization. And we buy land that protects the Appalachian Trail, protects the Blue Ridge Parkway, protects Great Smoky Mountains National Park, creates new parks for counties and the state of North Carolina. And so in that capacity, I buy land. I work with our land protection team, and we buy a lot of land. And we spend money that is appropriated by the state of North Carolina. And I lobby. I'm our government relations director also. I lobby in the legislature for increasing the pool of money available to buy land and create more parks. Then I've worked on some big federal projects that rely on a unique source of funding that comes from offshore oil drilling revenue, if you can believe it. Most of the conservation land in the United States is paid for out of a small portion of offshore oil drilling revenue on an annual basis. But the bill that created that mechanism was flawed at its inception. And I spent the last 13 years on a great team of people from around the country who worked to have that law fixed so that appropriators on Capitol Hill could not steal any of the $900 million that's supposed to go for that purpose. And we finally got to the Senate floor in 2020. Of course, a pandemic was right around the corner. which made it really hard. But we built support over a dozen years, and we finally passed legislation that would make the money for conservation out of oil drilling revenue permanent, so appropriators cannot steal it in any funding cycle. And that's a big, big deal for conservation.
You also received the Order of the Longleaf Pine. Tell people what that is. I know it's North Carolina's highest award for state service. It's given by the governor. What is that, and how does that feel to have that?
Well, it's an honor when anybody thinks that you are doing a good job. And we all have insecurities and on certain days think we're probably doing a poor job. But it was a nice affirmation. Some wonderful people from the Natural Heritage Program nominated me for that award. And Governor Perdue was kind enough to receive the application, I guess, and check off on it. So there's a plaque somewhere in my house. It's not on the wall. I should put it on the wall. But it's an honor to be included in a group of North Carolinians who have contributed a lot to the state. And I feel like I need to spend the rest of my career earning it. Maybe then I'll put it on the wall.
So that leads to like a what next for you. When I read this book and hear the way you describe this area, see your experience and the way you talk about it, and kind of the presence you have when you're talking, and thinking about, you can't really understand, I don't think, land conservation until you see the area. Have you ever thought of like doing something like an idea of like some type of TV show or like a YouTube series of like you kind of walking through this area, explaining what the area is, but also explaining the law behind it, why we have to protect it? It seems combining your experience with the law, with actually being able to see what you're fighting for and protecting, could really impact a lot of people around the whole country, right?
Well, thanks for the idea. although I will say that I speak passionately about my landscape where I live, but I also think it's really important to stress that everybody listening and everybody I've ever met feels passionately about one place or another, usually home. And if you are from the Pine Barrens of New Jersey or from the Sand Hills of Nebraska, I hope you feel as passionately about that place as I feel about the Roan Highlands landscape in Western North Carolina, because we need people to fight for all of these different landscapes. All are imperiled and all are in a state of change and flux. So I do love telling a story about my place, but mostly to set an example for how people can take passion that they feel for the place they love, often in their own backyard, and then learn to fight for it and advocate for it and add protections to it. And that does involve sharing, and it really does involve getting people outside. And television and these other media are powerful ways to do that, because not everybody can jump in the car and join a hike. I get that. But there are land trusts across North Carolina. There are 22 different land trusts, and then there's some national organizations operating in the state too. Wherever you are, there is somebody working on the issues that I work on, tailored to each landscape. So I recommend you find out who your local land trust is and the place you love the most, and just Google local land trust and your area, or you can go to the Land Trust Alliance website at lta.org and learn what your local land trust is and start helping them out. It could be a career.
I think that's a great place to end it, kind of with a call to action. I thank you for joining us, and I thank everyone for listening to this episode of the Campbell Law Reporter podcast. Do you have any last words as we go?
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. This is short of hosting a TV show, appearing on one, if that's what this is second best. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. And that concludes this episode of the Campbell Law Reporter.
This is the Campbell Law Reporter.
Thank you for listening to the Campbell Law Reporter podcast. We look forward to you joining us every other Wednesday at 7 a.m. for a new episode, which can be accessed through your preferred podcasting listening platform.
This
is the Campbell Law Reporter.